Welcome to The Coronavirus Effect, a podcast asking where do we grow from here? I am Sam Harris, your curious host. Society has never undergone such rapid changes in our lifetimes, and we all have the opportunity to learn and do something good. This podcast highlights the amazing things going on in the world and the ways that we can get involved. It's also a podcast where we discover how industries and the economy works and what the future could hold and how we can define it. If you are hoping to have an anxiety-induced panic attack, you may want to go somewhere else. There will be no live updates on the amount of people dying. There will be no scary dramatic music in the background. And there will be no reasons to crap yourself when you're already low on toilet paper. We are just going to host nice, informative discussions with nice people, and it's going to be great. Now, breathe. Today, we have Dame Stephanie Shirley on the podcast. She is a truly amazing woman and a living legend, so much so that her life is being made into a movie. She was a German Jew who was sent to Britain as a refugee in the Second World War, and she grew up here. She was prevented from being able to earn well or have a family and a job at the same time as a woman due to sexism back then. So she built the first remote programming agency back in the 60s, employing only women. This was before the home computer or email, and they were writing machine code in their kitchens whilst looking after kids and making dinner. By the 90s, and then the dot-com boom, the business was writing code for 75 of the Fortune 100 companies, and the business went on to be worth $3 billion. She is perhaps the greatest tech entrepreneur that you've never heard of. Her only child had severe autism, which caused an untold amount of problems and depression and issues that she had to deal with through her life. She is now one of the leading philanthropists and a force of positive change in the world. We talk about her life lessons, how to deal with the world crumbling around you, and how to rebuild a life and live one of purpose. She is a truly incredible woman, and this is a brilliant conversation, and I am humbled and honored to bring you Dame Stephanie Shirley. So, yeah, there's just so many interesting things in your story. I guess it kind of makes sense to start with your story from like the Kinder transport and getting out of Germany.
Yeah, it's not just that it was the start, but it was actually been the driving force of the whole of my long life. We were born in North Germany. My father was a judge, and he lost his job completely in 1933, the year that I was born. So things started to be difficult at that stage. And we finished up in Vienna, which was my mother's home city. And my parents did a really very brave thing. They organized for me to come out of Nazi Europe and sent me to England into the arms of strangers. They had a name and address. Said goodbye to us, thinking never to see us again. I say us because I was with my older sister. I was 5 years old. She was nine. And if you think how small a five-year-old is, I sort of think to send a five-year-old away, it was a horrendous journey, 2.5 days. The train was apparently about 1,000 children aged 5 to 16. And we slept on rolls of corrugated cardboard. I don't know what we ate. But there were only 2 adults for those 1,000 children, plus some young girls who were looking after some babies. And I always like to mention them because they were young. And I think courage is, you know, doubly special from a young person. They were traveling under a concession where they had agreed they could bring these babies out as long as they returned to what they must have known, Sam, was almost certain death. And the one I know of as a person, I never met her. She made 2 such journeys of love and brought out some babies. So it was a horrendous thing. And once we got to England, we were with a new country, new language, new food, new parents. And that's a change in your lifestyle, a change in your mindset, I think, that took a long time to assimilate, but has absolutely driven the rest of my life.
Crazy thing to go through, isn't it? Certainly compared to, I mean, we're going through some terrible things at the moment, but it's the scale of it's not really the same, or no bit.
I think it's interesting. It is worldwide. It's not just Germany and Italy. You know, when is America going to come in, and all those sorts of questions that we had. But it is really worldwide, and it makes one think of solutions that there also need to be global solutions. We can do a certain amount here, but obviously much of it needs to be done on a global basis.
Yeah, there's no like sort of specific front line exactly. Sort of, it's kind of everywhere in every country, and every human can be affected by it, kind of thing, which is, so it's a very strange moment. Yes. That the whole world sort of stopping and pausing and experiencing the same thing.
I think it's strange that we're working from home, which I have always done since the age of 30, and I have really learned to have systems that allow some division between home life and business life. Whenever you ask women what they want from their employer, they always come up with the same two things. They want flexibility and they want home life balance. And my company, which I set up for women, was flexible to the extreme. And we certainly allowed home life balance. Not everybody managed it. Not everybody is able to work from home. How are you finding it?
I've been working from home for like the last 10 years on and off anyway. So it's not, but I mean, I kind of grew up with email and computers and stuff. What I find nuts is that you did this in the 60s when no one had ever heard of remote working, and you couldn't just email people anything. And I'm still baffled how that worked.
Even the simple telephone, we used to ask applicants, not do you have a telephone, what's your number, but do you have access to a telephone? So not everybody did. And we sort of said, unless you have access to a telephone, you can't work with us.
Wow. That's kind of nuts. But yeah, so like on the remote side of things, like how did you go around finding business and getting your name out there if you're based from home?
Well, the original work came from ex-colleagues and my ex-employer, fairly natural. And once we got through two or three tasks like that, you sort of suddenly realise, where is the work going to come from? And I had to learn to actually market, and I had to learn to sell. And when I started off selling, I thought I had to show off my technical expertise. But of course, selling isn't like that at all. It's much more about listening to potential customers, listening really hard, and then making sure that your offer matches their needs expressed or implied. So it was a very slow growth curve. For example, when I started my company, I had been earning £2,000 a year, which was a very high salary for a mere woman. Now, in the first year in my business, we earned, as a company, £700. The next one was £1,700, then £27, then £37. We had all those sevens, which is why I could remember them. But it was basically, what I'm saying is very, very slow. And that meant we actually developed some very sound processes, which stood us in good stead. One of our very first contracts was with a management consultancy where we were paid to develop software standards of management control protocols. And that meant that we had access to those very sophisticated methods ourselves. We even paid to update them over the years. And so we started off with the tools of being very professional about software, which at that time was highly creative and quite unstructured. You know, it'll be ready next week. I've only got 3 more bugs to get out and so on. And next week, more bugs to get out. I mean, it was really quite strange. But that was one of the reasons for our success. I think the other was to do with the fact that we were all home-based and part-time and female. And I needed to disguise that somewhat from our professional clients. And so we moved to fixed price, one of the very first people to use fixed price for software. And that disguised the whole lot. So we had to actually have sufficient experience of writing software to be able to break things down to what we called work parcels, none of which was bigger than something we'd successfully done before. And in that way, we gradually got to from tiny little contracts. Towards the end, we were doing software contracts of $500 million, and that takes some doing.
Yeah, so you said you needed to disguise the fact that people were female. Why and how?
Why? Because women were at that time very much classed as second-class citizens. They were not considered anything. Programming software came out of the clerical industry. And so a lot of it was considered to be low-level routine work, which the men didn't want to do. And in the 60s, that began to change as the men realized how very high paid it was and how interesting it was as well. The other reason was that there were many, many women who had left full-time work on marriage or when their first child was expected and had therefore been at home, domestic responsibilities, childcare, and they leapt at the opportunity of doing professional work in their own time, in their own homes, at a high level. So I had access to a workforce in very short supply, and it remained all female for 13 years, I think, when in 1975, equal opportunities legislation came in this country. And so it was illegal to have a policy of employing women. And so we began to employ the men as well.
But it's a nice thing to have, as in, I guess, that's when the rest of the workforces would be perhaps employing more women. So it makes sense that you employ more men. But yeah, what do you think about, like, in the current feminism movements, which have gone in kind of waves, and then still more stuff to go?
Are you thinking about the Me Too movement?
Not so much, more just like the general, like, ways that we can still make society more equal and what we're kind of missing out by not doing it, perhaps.
I think business is really starting to understand that diversity leads to innovation. Mm. And what happens in business at the moment is innovation. And some of the diverse sectors of the workforce, in particular people with autism, are highly innovative. And you also know that if you have a team that is mixed, they come up with solutions that are really new. So there is a move to measure diversity in the workforce, measure diversity, or in particular women, on corporate boards. And that has had some success. The first country to have really a drive to get women onto boards of directors was Norway. And they aim to get 30%, I think, of their board members female, which they achieved. Takes time. Gives us another 400 years.
Let's say we can do it quicker than that. As in, we're in a time of radical change right now. Maybe some things happen that are different.
Do you think that the world will go back to how it was before the end of this lockdown?
It's nice to see the other side of things. If we've lived in this, like, reality as it is, to realize that suddenly the whole thing can be broken and we can live in a completely different way. Like, everyone can stop all of these things that drive the economy and are ruining the planet.
With the environmental issues, at the moment our rivers are nice and clean, the air quality is better. You know, a lot of things that we've been saying we want from society for some time, and we didn't know how to get it. I know so many people who are seriously worried. They've lost their job, and that gives a pressure that might stimulate innovation. A lot of people were going to business on their own account.
Yeah, so it's potentially a breeding ground for innovation and good new things to happen, but it's also a driver to get back to normal as quickly as possible and try and stimulate anything that will make more money, such as, like, the travel industry and things that we didn't really need.
One of the very positive things that have come out was that for the first time, Britain has said we're going to get people off the streets and into proper accommodation. Mm. And we've been talking about this forever and a day, but now it's actually happened. Why now? Mm. It's not as if, you know, suddenly accommodation has become free, but we've made it happen now because people are actually thinking of each other rather than me, me, me. We've become very selfish with years, almost a generation, of easy living.
Yeah, I certainly think, like, a lot of stuff won't get instantly forgotten in terms of we suddenly appreciate human connection a lot more and recognise our neighbours. And certainly my friends that are still living in streets, they're all suddenly got to know everyone they live near, because in London you have no clue who lives on your street, but suddenly everyone's in like a big WhatsApp group or a Facebook group of people that happen to live next to you, and like you sort of, you just look out for each other a lot more, and it's kind of cute. So it's certainly a bonding.
Well, certainly older people like me are getting lots and lots of phone calls. People just basically checking, are you managing all right? Anything we can do? Really very nice to know. You learn who your friends are. These are friends, basically. I'm sufficiently active and mobile that I'm offering help to some of my neighbours who are
You shouldn't be going
old.
Out. I'm hearing that. But yeah, it's certainly positive on that side. But yeah, they're sort of more global. I don't know how many things will change or not. And it's in like, they've already cancelled the Copenhagen 22 talks this year for climate. So why can't it just happen virtually anyway? As in, it's not until November. Can't they just all dial in? Like, all the governments
doing that? They'll do something like that, yes.
Yeah. We'll see. What do you think, like, the most important, like, thing that we can try and change for when we put society back together?
Well, being a software person, I do believe that in the big changes that are incipient in artificial intelligence, I know people are scared of it, and it will make a lot of changes itself in how society works. I used to think that, well, of course, there's nothing to be scared of there because artificial intelligence, the machine will only do what the programmer has, what I've told it to do. Mm. But AI has actually moved on from that and is coming up with solutions that are very interesting. It's also coming up with dangers like false news and so on, where we really don't know where information comes from anymore. The rate of change has never been so fast. And yet, you know, in a way, it'll never be as slow again because it's accelerating all the time.
Yeah, but what do you think we should do with the technology if there was something we could like aim for?
I would aim for world peace and the end of national boundaries. I do think at the moment,
yes,
people are starting to think, well, this is a global problem, perhaps we should go for a global solution. Now, a lot of things are global, in particular the environment, and if we can start working globally. But it is a bit of an idealist, and most sophisticated people just laugh at me.
Yeah, but I mean, I certainly agree. As in, like, viruses don't care how rich you are or which
body
you belong to. It's sort of, it's a species problem. It's not who you are or where you are. And the same with the environment. And it's going to be a bit different. Like, some places will be more inhabitable than others and things if stuff goes really badly wrong. But still, the effects of people, like, see, migrating from different parts is still going to impact everyone.
I think there's plenty of opportunity in space. I mean, in the 50s, I joined something called the Interplanetary Society, where we were starting to think of getting out of the Earth's atmosphere. It was at that level. Well, now people like Branson are talking about populating other parts of space. I mean, these are exciting things that are within one's comprehension that they might happen, not certainly not in my lifetime, but perhaps in yours.
It's certainly really interesting. As in terms of the world now, it's much harder to be like an explorer, and there's no piece of land you can go and find that hasn't been reached by many people, kind of thing. And but I mean, if you take a step back and think of like the general insignificance of your life in terms of number of people, being like the first people to colonize Mars is like hugely amazing compared to, well, I sat at home and didn't do too much. It was slightly nicer and easier, but actually I could have done this crazy epic thing. It's like, yeah, I guess on that side of things it makes sense.
I think going back to my own motivation, I want the world to be a fairer place, and certainly for women and for autistic people I have helped to make it a more fair place. Because at the moment, there is this extraordinary division between the rich and the poor. And I'm not just only talking in financial terms, but in health terms and others. Mm. So I think you and I could put the world to rights if we had enough time.
Interesting to hear your thoughts. And also, I guess you've also been very good at dealing with things like letting go of your business and sort of and losing money and stuff, which a lot of people might be going through at the moment. And sort of how you came to terms with these kind of things would be interesting.
When I talked about trying to lead a spiritual life, the title of my memoir is Let It Go, and that's a Buddhist concept of making sure that the rancor of the past doesn't ruin the present and tomorrow. And that really has stood me in good stead to leave things behind, to not bear grudges, to continue always with goodwill. And many of the spiritual aspects of life are concerned with other people and are open to misinterpretation, so things can go wrong. But basically, I work almost quite hard to keep me as a sort of three-quarters full glass. I'm a three-quarters full glass person. I do see the best side of people. I try to ignore the weaknesses. And certainly as a manager, I have been like that for 30 years. But when I started, I was very much do this, do that, because I felt that I knew how to do things better than anybody else, and I would show them how to do it. But now I get on much better by listening to other people. And I had the experience in my second job working under Tommy Flowers of Bletchley Park coding fame. And he was a superb, inspirational people manager. He wasn't a mentor. I only just knew him. But he certainly inspired me. As you know, you could become a manager. And my company got very big eventually without turning into a money person, without turning into a big fat boss.
And a lot of useful points there. Certainly, I found trying to get the best out of people. It's a funny one when you kind of want to point out their mistakes and how they can do better, but it's better to kind of try and just be positive.
This is good.
And
this
do
is
more
good.
The whole way, kind of thing.
Yes. Took me a long time to learn that.
Yeah. Try and be like, okay, well, you're really good at all of these things. You could do like two things maybe better, and just like the few things that will motivate them to try a bit harder on something that they will do, rather than just like laying everything out. Oh, this was wrong, this was wrong, this was wrong, this was wrong. And yeah, it's a hard one.
I like to hear sort of when I was in my company still, you know, roars of laughter as I walked down a corridor. So people having a good time. We should enjoy work. Work shouldn't be something that we do when we'd rather be doing something else.
Definitely. Anything else you might want to cover in terms of all of your recent work that's kind of defined your life on autism that we haven't really touched on at all?
Well, one of the IT projects that I was the initial funder, it was not my idea, was the Oxford Internet Institute. Mm. And when I was talking about false news, I mean, they're currently working. I mean, it's quite an established interdisciplinary part of Oxford University now. But it's looking at the social, economic, legal, and ethical aspects of life online. And I think that's very relevant for the current time. And they are certainly working to find out techniques from where, that if you get a message, you can actually find out where it comes from. Mm. Because there's this lovely expression, astroturfing, meaning that an advertising message goes out deliberately designed to look like a grassroots message from the public. And it isn't, it's a straight advertising, hence the term astroturfing. So these are the sort of things that in the IT world I still touch on because I follow what the Oxford Internet Institute does. On the autism side, I think things have moved on a great deal. People are beginning to realize that people with autism, it's a brain disorder. They see the world in a completely different way, and they are very innovative for that reason. It used to be considered to be a disability, something that you had to try and improve, something that you would like to cure, and that people with autism should behave as you and I do. In fact, we've now moved to a society in which we need to understand how people with autism work, and we need to change in order to reach out to this 1 in 100 people are involved with autism. It's not insignificant. And really cherish the differences rather than sort of saying they have a disability, we're not bothered.
Yeah, it's a really good way of fundamentally changing the way we look at it to actually be much more sensible. So really interesting. Nice. So the work that you're supporting, are they working to make that happen, or are they kind of treating people with autism in that way? And is there like a public agenda for making this happen?
Well, one of my charities is Autistica, which funds medical research into autism. And they have fund, for example, I think 45 different researchers, mainly in the UK. There's a little bit of work going on in the States, I think. But the big change is on the society side for autistic people to lead longer, healthier, happier lives. And that really brings home what I think every human being should be doing, and that is concentrating on the quality of life, not the material quality, but the intellectual and emotional quality of happy lives.
It's good to hear these things are going on. Yeah, so it must be really nice to reach a point where you can kind of just focus on philanthropy and changing the world for the better.
Most people my age are thinking, what should we do today? It's about the current lockdown. But I always have something to get up for each morning. One of the things I'm looking forward to, I thought it was going to be this year, but probably it'll be deferred till next year, is that they're making a film of the book of Letting Go. As far as having a director and a producer and talking about who's going to play me. And I think, it should be such fun to see that interpretation.
Yeah, definitely.
Yes.
It's going to be amazing. Thank you very much. And I'm really looking forward to the movie, and I hope everything goes well the next year. And so, and don't go out, regardless of if people need help. Stay safe.
Take care. Stay safe. Stay at home. Good. Exactly. Very nice to meet you. Enjoy it.
All right.
Bye.
Ciao. That was Dame Stephanie Shirley spreading wisdom and joy. Such a lovely lady and a very grounding conversation. If you want to hear the full interview with her and some tales from the rest of her life, I'm sure you'll enjoy catching the episode on the Growth Mindset podcast. Next week, we will be having the Managing Director of Techstars here talking about tech and investing, and also Kathleen Black, who works with the top real estate investors across America and Canada, to talk about property. In the meantime, I have been starting a club for thrill-seeking and adventure while stuck indoors. When you can't explore outside, you can have adventures in your own mind through silly challenges and explorations of what you can do with your body. So whether that's learning to do a Rubik's Cube, going on a fast, or just stupid exercises, there's a lot of things that you can learn about the world and yourself by embracing the spirit for adventure. So I'll be introducing that concept and inviting you along as well. And in the meantime, stay safe and happy and spread some love and joy, and give anyone you can give a hug to in a safe manner a hug. Anyone else, just a virtual hug will do. And this was my virtual hug to you. Thank you for listening.